All right, so we're going to be starting in Genesis chapter 37. Genesis chapter 37. And starting in verse 1, I'm going to read. And it says, "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan." Now, I already have to stop right there. I know we're never going to get through the whole story of Joseph at this rate. But we need some context for this statement at the beginning of Genesis chapter 37. Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. That context comes from chapter 36. Now, chapter 36 isn't the most fun chapter to read because it has a lot of genealogy. But we won't read the genealogy part. Let's look at it, though, because it's included in the Word of God for a reason. So if we look at Genesis chapter 36 and verse 6, we find out something about Esau and Jacob. Esau and Jacob were two brothers, and at this point in time, they're finally living together again in the same place. Jacob had finally obeyed the Lord's commands and returned to his family as the Lord had told him to. But there's a problem, and it's a familiar-sounding problem. This is Genesis chapter 36, verse 6. Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle, and all his animals, and all his goods which he had gained in the lands of Canaan, and went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. So this might sound familiar to you if you remember way back to when we were talking about Abraham. Abraham and Lot couldn't live together because they had too many possessions. So it was a similar kind of thing. But now here in Genesis 36, we find out the reason why they couldn't dwell together. Because after all, Canaan is a big place, right? There should be plenty of room. But what's the problem here? The problem is this is the land where they are strangers. So they can't just go anywhere they want and graze their cattle wherever they want. They have to take, you know, whatever's left over. The people who are living in the land, they get first pick. So Esau and Jacob are strangers in this land. So there's not enough room for them because of that. And so Esau goes, in verse 8, Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. And then we could read all about the children of Esau. Esau settles down in Mount Seir. He joins as allies with the people there. And his children become a great nation. And you'll notice in this genealogy, the word chief is repeated a lot. Right, there's kings and chiefs and all kinds of great men that come from Edom, and it says that there were kings in the land of Esau even before there were kings in the land of Israel. So Esau becomes this great nation. He goes and he finds himself a permanent home in Mount Seir. But Jacob is not like that. Jacob is still living as a stranger in the land of Canaan. So that's chapter 37, verse 1. Now, you remember the promise of God to Jacob, that the older will serve the younger. And Jacob, in fact, even gained the blessing of the Lord, that he was going to be the son who was the most important. His brothers were going to bow down to him. In fact, nations were going to bow down to him. And yet here he is, living as a stranger in the land of Canaan. So it doesn't look like God's promise has come true for him. It looks like Esau is really the more powerful brother, the more successful brother in the world's eyes. He certainly would be. And here Jacob is living as a stranger. So that theme is going to be important in the story of Jacob's son, Joseph. So we can continue reading now. We can get past verse 1 and move on to verse 2 of chapter 37. Verse 2, this is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. Now, the sons of Jacob did a lot of really bad things. So it's not really surprising that Joseph might have something bad to report about them. Right? Like, they literally went and killed a whole village of people. So they're getting into some serious stuff here. So verse 3 says, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. So there's a problem in Jacob's family. Not only is he a stranger in the land, but there's also a problem of sin in Jacob's family. And some of this has been passed down from generation to generation. So you'll see a few different things. So this is the first one. Jacob is showing favoritism. Now, where did he learn that? Well, if you go back to the previous generation, you could see Isaac showing favoritism to Esau, Rebekah showing favoritism to Jacob, right? So he learned that from his parents. But that's not the only place where we see that. We also saw earlier with, actually, maybe I didn't talk about this, but you could see earlier in Genesis, I think, 31, Jacob shows favoritism to his wives. So he shows favoritism to Rachel instead of Leah. He has two wives, but he loves Rachel more than Leah. Maybe we could even go back further than that, because we already could see problems in the life of Abraham, because Abraham took that second wife, Hagar, and that caused all kinds of problems in his own family. And if we really, really want to go back, you can go all the way back to the very beginning of the book of Genesis, and you could see Cain and Abel. Now, here it's not a problem of favoritism. With Cain and Abel, the Lord accepts Abel's offering. He doesn't accept Cain's offering. And it seems to be that's because Cain was not doing what was good. He was not doing something right, so the Lord didn't accept him. So there's all these instances where siblings are put at odds with each other because of favoritism. Here it's Jacob, or Israel. He's creating this problem. He loves Joseph more than all his brothers. And so in verse 4, when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. So this is now the second generation where this has happened, where the children hate each other because of the favoritism that's being shown by their parents. So this seems like Jacob's family is spiraling further and further into this sin, and there really is no escape for them. So things are not looking good. They couldn't speak peaceably to him. Now, verse 5, Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers. And they hated him even more. Now, you'll notice here, there's going to be some repetition. So verse 6, he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. Now, this has kind of been, this moment has been prolonged a little bit. Right? You notice it doesn't just say, Joseph had a dream and told it to his brothers, and then he just launches into it. It reiterates these words. So Joseph had a dream, he told it to his brothers. It jumps ahead and says, by the way, they're going to hate him even more. And then it says, he says, please hear this dream which I have dreamed, right? He doesn't need to say that, but it's setting us up. This is something important, right? This is being highlighted for us. This dream is going to be important for the story. So please hear this dream which I have dreamed. Joseph had a dream. He told it to his brothers. There we were. Actually, in Hebrew, the word is behold. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. So Joseph had this dream that all his brother's sheaves bowed down to his sheaf. And his brothers are not impressed. Verse 8, his brothers said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? In Hebrew, this is more like, reigning, shall you reign over us? Or ruling, shall you rule over us? So this is a bit poetic here, right? In Hebrew, when something is poetic, you repeat the same thing twice, just using different words. So if you look in the Psalms, you see that all the time. You see a phrase, and then the same phrase is repeated, only using a different wording. So here we have some poetry. Reigning shall you reign over us, ruling shall you rule over us. So this is focusing our attention in on the brothers' response here to this dream. They don't believe that it's going to happen, and they're mocking. Is this really going to happen? Well, will it happen? That's the big question in this story. Of course, we kind of know that maybe the end of the story, so it spoils it a little bit. But pretend you don't know the end, right? This is the big question that keeps us on the edge of our seat. So they hated him even more. Notice how many times it mentions that they hated him. It's mentioned twice, at the beginning and at the end. They hated him even more because of his dreams and for his words. So then he dreamed still another dream, right? So again, it's repeated twice. That's going to be important later on. Repeated twice. He dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, or behold, I had another dream. I'm sure his brothers are all like, oh, that's great. No. Behold, I had another dream. And this time, and behold, the sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. So now we're on celestial proportions here. The sun, moon, and stars are bowing down to Joseph. So he told it to his father, and his brothers. Now remember the first time his brothers rebuked him. Reigning shall you reign over us, ruling shall you rule over us. Now it's his father. So his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come down, come to bow down to the earth before you? So now his father asks the same question. Is this really going to happen, right? So this is what's keeping us at the edge of our seat. Is this actually going to happen? Verse 11, his brothers envied him. His father kept the matter in mind. Okay, so that's the setup. Then his brothers, in verse 12, went to feed their father's flocks in Shechem. Shechem is the town where they murdered everyone in the town, essentially. They killed all the men in the town. Right, so now it's an empty wasteland, I guess, and they went to go feed their flocks there. So Israel said to Joseph in verse 13, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. Right, in Hebrew, this is literally, behold me. This is a phrase that people use to say, here I am, I'm ready for instructions. Right, so you'll see this in the book of Genesis several times. The first time is with Abraham. When God speaks to him, he says, here I am, right? So this is something people say to indicate obedience. So Joseph is an obedient son, and we see that here. He says, here I am. Then verse 14, he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flock and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now, there was a lot of words spent there talking about how Israel sent Joseph out. This is, of course, a very significant moment in Joseph's life, right? Plot spoilers, right? Some bad things are going to happen to him as a result, a direct result of his obedience right here. If Joseph had said, I don't really feel like, you know, wandering all over the earth, looking after my older brothers, but that's not what he says. He obeys his father, and how is he going to get rewarded for it? Well, it's going to be a disaster. And you have to wonder, how many times would Joseph look back on this moment and think, if I only hadn't gone. But he did go. He obeyed his father. Now, verse 15. This is the real crazy part of this story. Verse 15. A certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. So there's Joseph. He's just wandering around in a field. And it just so happens that a certain man finds him. And the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? And how many times must Joseph have thought, if I only hadn't met that guy, if he only hadn't asked me, what are you seeking? So verse 16, so he said, I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And you know, what are the odds that this random guy knows where his brothers are? But of course he does. And so verse 17, the man said, they have departed from here, and I heard them say, right? So he just so happened to overhear them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. How many times must Joseph have thought, if I only hadn't met this random guy in a field, if all these coincidences hadn't lined up, so many bad things would not have happened to me. But why did Joseph meet this man in the field? Well, maybe eventually Joseph came to the conclusion, actually, you know what? This was from God. In fact, we know that that's the conclusion he comes to. He tells his brothers as much later on. Right, so these coincidences, it's not really a coincidence. This is showing that what happens to Joseph, it's not a result of Joseph's plans or his father's plans. No one could possibly have control over this situation, over all of these coincidences, other than God. So why in the world would God do all of these terrible things to Joseph and make him meet this man? So the Lord had him meet this man, and he goes and finds his brothers in Dothan. Verse 18, when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. So we see that legacy of sin that was there, even with Cain and Abel, when Cain became jealous of Abel and killed him. That was there with Jacob and his brother Esau. Esau wanted to kill Jacob because of jealousy. That's even come down now to this next generation, and they want to kill Joseph. So verse 19. Look at this, verse 19. They said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming. Verse 20, come, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. Right? So that question is still there. what's going to become of Joseph's dreams? And his brothers are here. We're going to take care of this. We're going to throw him. We're going to kill him. Throw him into a pit. And then we'll see what's going to become of his dreams. All right. What is going to become of his dreams? Who has control over that? Well, his brothers think that they have control over that. So they're going to make their plans for evil, and they're going to choose their outcome. They're going to destroy their brother. But verse 21, Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands. So now Reuben, he's the oldest son. So he's the one who's supposed to take the leadership here. And we're going to see him attempt to do that, but he's going to fail. So Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, "Let us not kill him." Now, I'm going to share with you some speculation that I heard. Here's the speculation, that whenever in the Bible, sometimes you see quotations, and in the middle, as a person's talking, it suddenly interrupts the quotation by repeating the end, like in this example, "And Reuben said." So we have, "Reuben said, let us not kill him," and then it's repeated, "And Reuben said to them, shed no blood." So, right, why is there that interruption there? One speculation is maybe that's supposed to be like a kind of to indicate an awkward silence, right? Like the person spoke and he said something, "Let us not kill him," and then everyone turns and looks at him, and right, there's, and so then he continues on and says, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So Reuben is going to try to rescue his brother, but he's going to try to do it in this kind of sneaky way, where he's like, "Oh, let's just throw him into a pit for now." And then he's going to try to save him. So that's Reuben. So it came to pass, verse 23, when Joseph had come to his brothers, they stripped Joseph of his tunic. So remember that. They ripped off his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. So remember that detail as well. They ripped off his tunic. They threw him into a pit. And the pit was empty. There was no water in it. Well, that's good, right? Otherwise, he would have drowned. So they threw him into the pit. Verse 25, they sat down to eat a meal, right? So here they are. They just took their brother, threw him into a pit, and now they're just going to sit down and have a nice meal. You're right. You see how warped these brothers' perspective has become, that they're able to just eat while right after they've done such a terrible thing to their own brother. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and it just so happened at this critical moment, they lifted up their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So just at that crucial moment, a caravan of merchants happens to go by. And, you know, if they hadn't gone by, maybe Reuben would have been successful in rescuing Joseph from his brothers. But because that caravan happened to go by at that time, Joseph is going to end up a slave in Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, now Judah is going to take a turn, and Judah is going to be the leader here. So he's going to suggest a course of action, and the brothers are going to listen to Judah. So Reuben is maybe should be taking charge, but Judah is the one who's actually going to lead his brothers. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood?" Oh, what kind of a question is that? What's the benefit to us if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hands be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." Wow, that's a great moral compass there. You know what? You know what, guys? We really shouldn't kill our brother, right? Because after all, he's our flesh, right? So killing him, that would probably be wrong. So let's just sell him as a slave instead, right? So you could see the twisted morality here. Now, one interesting thing. Where do you think the last time this phrase, "our flesh," like someone is, you're my flesh, where do you think the last time that phrase came up, right? It came up the first time in the Garden of Eden, but there's one other time in the book of Genesis where someone talks like that, and that's Laban. Laban says to Jacob, "Should you indeed serve me for nothing, since you are my, I believe, my flesh," maybe it was "my bones," right? We're relatives, so "should you indeed serve me for nothing?" Of course, we know that Laban treats Jacob like a slave, essentially. So that's the environment where these brothers grew up, and we see that thinking, maybe that violence from their childhood, that way of thinking about your relatives as people who you can exploit, that has continued on to this next generation in these brothers. And so they say, you know, "We won't kill him, but let's sell him as a slave instead. Then Midianite traders pass by, verse 28. So the text will switch back and forth between saying Ishmaelites and Midianites. There's different ideas about why that is. Maybe there's, who knows what the situation was, if there was two caravans, if there was a mixed group, all kinds of different possibilities. But one suggestion I've seen for maybe why the text switches back and forth so consistently between these two words is maybe this reflects Joseph's confusion, right? It's kind of giving us Joseph's insight. He comes out of this pit, and there's an Ishmaelite, there's a Midianite, and it's all very confusing for him. But regardless, so these traders pass by. His brothers pulled Joseph up, lifted him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites, right? So you see it switches back and forth pretty consistently, to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit. So I guess, I don't know where he had gone. Maybe he had gone to find help or something. But he was away. He wasn't there at that crucial moment. So he returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit. And he tore his clothes, and he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" So, I mean, he's a bit dramatic, but I guess that's understandable under the circumstances. So, but he's thinking about himself, right? Like, oh, what am I going to do now that Joseph has been sold as a slave? So he says, "What shall I do?" And so they come up with their plan. So verse 31, they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, dipped the tunic in the blood, and they sent the tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" Right? They're not even going to lie about it explicitly. They're just saying, "Oh, do you recognize this? Do you recognize this tunic? We found it." You know, I mean, technically, everything they said is true. They're deceiving their father. Now, they're also following in a legacy here, right? You remember Jacob deceived his father. In fact, he also used goat skins, he used goat skins on his arms, right, to deceive his father. He deceives his father, tricks his father into thinking that he was his brother. Now they're doing the same thing. A goat was also involved in this deception, right? They killed a goat and put its blood on the tunic and sent it to their father. And if we go on to chapter 38, you'll see that Tamar, who's Judah's daughter-in-law, right, so the next generation, she also does something similar. She deceives her father-in-law, and there's also a goat involved in that story. So you see this legacy of sin, right, from father to son, it's a disaster. And in fact, if we expand our scope and we don't care about the goats anymore, you can see many other examples. So Rachel deceives her father, Laban, by stealing some idols from him. So you could see Abraham and Isaac lying about their wives, right? So this legacy of lies has been passed down through the generations, and in fact, it's gotten really out of control here. So, right, Jacob's family, it's not looking good for them at all. Remember this chapter started out in verse 2. This is the history of Jacob, the generations of Jacob. It's not going well. So Jacob is deceived, and he thinks his son is dead. Meanwhile, he's sold down in Egypt. Now, I guess I'm going to skip chapter 38. That's the story of Tamar. That's really tied into this whole story of Joseph. But we already had teaching on this maybe a while ago. But we had teaching on Genesis 38 that I remember, so I'm not going to go over that again. But just to make the general comment, Tamar deceives her father, Judah. Now, Judah does not behave in a good way in this chapter, right? His sons are so wicked that the Lord just strikes them dead, right? There's instant judgment for Judah's sons. They're just struck dead. And you have to wonder what Judah was thinking as he sees his sons being struck dead for their sins about the things that he himself had done, right? He deserved to be struck down by the Lord as well. Why wasn't he struck down? Well, the Lord had mercy on him, clearly. Judah also doesn't take care of his daughter-in-law Tamar as he was supposed to. And she ends up deceiving him, right? It's this whole terrible story. And when he finds out that she's gotten pregnant, he's about to kill her, right? He wants to execute judgment on her. And then she suddenly reveals the truth to him, right? She gives him some objects, and she says, "Do you recognize who these are? Who's these belong to?" Right? It's kind of similar to what Judah did to his own father. "Do you recognize this tunic?" Tamar says, "Do you recognize this signet ring and this staff?" And Judah comes face to face with his sin, and he says, "You know what? She's been more righteous than I have." So maybe this story is part of how Judah comes to recognize that he is really guilty, and comes to realize that he is sinful and he deserves judgment. There's also another interesting thing in this story, which is Tamar gives birth to twins, and even though one is supposed to come out first, right, he sticks out his hand, and they think he's going to be the firstborn, but somehow the one who is going to be second, he comes out first, right? He passes his brother and becomes the firstborn son, right? So the younger son comes before the firstborn son. That's been a theme in the book of Genesis so far. Joseph here is, he's not the youngest, but he's certainly a younger son. Is he going to come out on top? Well, Judah's very immoral behavior in chapter 38 is contrasted with Joseph's very moral behavior in chapter 39. So let's take a look at chapter 39. This is a really interesting story. So we remember what's been happening so far. There's been a series of coincidences in Joself's life that have led him to this place of disaster, really far from what the Lord promised him. The Lord promised him, "You're going to be in charge. Everyone is going to bow down to you." And instead, the exact opposite is happening to him. All right? So this is a story that's, of course, not just for Joseph, right? This is a story that applies to our lives as well. The Lord has made many great promises to us, promises for good. But sometimes in our lives, things don't seem to line up with the promises that God has made for us. It seems like things are going really badly when the Lord has promised to do good for us. Right? He's blessed us, but it doesn't always look that way. This is what happens to Joseph. Chapter 39, verse 1. Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. Verse 2. It's an absolutely crazy verse in the context. The Lord was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Right? The Lord was with Joseph. He's a slave. Right? He was just sold by his brothers as a slave. But the text has the nerve to tell us the Lord was with Joseph and the Lord was making him successful. Well, okay, so he's a slave, but he's successful as a slave in his master's house. So in the circumstances that he's in, the Lord makes him successful. And his master, verse 3, saw that the Lord was with him. Right? The last time we saw this was Laban. Laban saw that Jacob, the Lord was with Jacob. Same thing with Joseph. His master saw the Lord was with Joseph, and that the Lord made all he did to prosper in his hand. So verse 4, Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put under his authority. When's the last time we've seen that in the book of Genesis? Everything is put under his authority. I think that would have to be Adam, right? In the Garden of Eden, the Lord puts everything in creation under the authority of Adam. So Adam was put in charge of all of his master's house, right? All of the Lord's house, right? The physical creation, all of the earth. Adam was put in charge, but there was one thing that Adam could not have, wasn't there, right? There's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And his wife Eve saw that that fruit of that tree looked really good, and she took it, and she gave it to her husband, and Adam ate from it. So now Joseph has been put in a similar position of responsibility. He's in charge of all of his master's house. And it says, the Lord blessed his master's house for Joseph's sake. And verse 6, thus he left all that he had in Joseph's hands. He did not know what he had except for the bread which he ate. Now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So he looked good on the outside, and well, it came to pass after these things, verse 7, that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. So she sees something that looks good, and she wants it. Maybe we could be reminded a little bit of Eve looking at the fruit of the tree and how it looked good. Its appearance was that it was good for food. So it came to pass that she cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Verse 8, but he refused, and he said to his master's wife, "Look, My master does not know what is with me in the house, and he has committed all that he has to my hands. There is no one greater than I in his house than I, nor has he kept back anything from me but you." All right, so there's that statement. There's one thing, only one thing that's been kept back from Joseph, one thing he can't have. "Because you are his wife, how then can I do this great wickedness and sin against my master?" That's not what he says. Right? You have to pay attention to your Bibles, make sure I don't trick you, right? He says, "How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" Right? The sin is not against Joseph's master, right? Joseph recognizes he's serving the Lord. So he's not going to disobey the Lord like Adam did. So Joseph is, I don't know if there's another character in the book of Genesis who is presented with a temptation like this and overcomes it. But certainly Joseph is coming here at the end. I think, right, he's one of the only major characters that doesn't have any sin recorded. Now, that doesn't mean he didn't sin, but it means that he's being presented here as a person who overcomes temptation, unlike Adam. So that's going to be really important. So he doesn't give in. So this temptation continues, and it gets to the point where Joseph has to run away, run outside, just to get away from it, right? He has to physically remove himself from the situation, but that's what he does. He does whatever he needs to do to get away, to overcome this temptation, but Potiphar's wife grabs his garment, and as he's running away, she pulls it off of him. This might maybe would give Joseph some deja vu here, the time when his brothers stripped off his tunic. So let's see where the story is going. She pulled his garment off of him, and he runs outside, and then she accuses him of trying to force her, and she goes to her husband and accuses him, and Joseph's master is angry and throws him in prison, the places where a king's prisoners were confined. This is in verse 20. He put him there in the prison, and in the next chapter, Joseph is going to say, "I have done nothing wrong that they should put me in this dungeon." Now, in Hebrew, the word isn't dungeon literally. It's literally a pit, right? So this prison, it's in a pit and a dungeon, right? So this is the second time Joseph's had someone rip off his tunic, throw him into a pit. All right, the pit is the prison this time. So this is the second time. Remember, Joseph had two dreams that God was going to bless him and make him great. And we read at the beginning of this chapter that the Lord was with him. The Lord was making him prosper. And now the worst possible thing that could happen to him happens. I don't think there could be any disaster in his situation greater than this. And the text has the nerve to say in verse 21, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him mercy and gave him favor in the sight of the prison keeper." The Lord was with Joseph in the prison, and the keeper of the prison committed all to Joseph's hands all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. So once again, the Lord has made him, right, quote unquote, prosperous in this disastrous situation. All right, so what are we to make of this? Clearly, when we read that the Lord is with Joseph, it means something very different from what we might think if we just were basing it off of a human perspective. All right, the Lord being with us doesn't mean that things are going to go well for us. In fact, it might mean that the worst possible thing is happening. But the Lord is with us, and he has a plan, and he has a plan for Joseph. And this is part of his plan for Joseph. So, right, it's not really Potiphar's wife or Potiphar or Joseph's brothers or any of these other people who are in charge of Joseph. It's the Lord. The Lord is the one who puts him in the situation of slavery. The Lord is the one who puts him in the prison. And the Lord is with him wherever he goes. And the Lord is doing something through him wherever he goes. So the keeper of the prison, verse 23, did not look into anything that was under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made him prosper. All right, I'm going to stop there a little bit early, since that's a good place to stop. Didn't get to the end of the book of Genesis, so I guess I'll have to come back in the future. Yes, I'd love to visit here from time to time. I guess I'll be here in 2 weeks, so I'll also be here then because my family is coming up to visit. But then after that, I'll be away, and then I'll be going to China. But I'll be back on visits in the winter and in the summer, so maybe I can come up here and visit you all. It's been really great being here at Fellowshipping in this meeting. I've been blessed a lot by all of you in different ways. The Lord has used all of you in my life to shape me and to change me, so I'm really appreciated of all of that, and I'll continue to pray that the Lord will continue to work in all of us, right? He is in control of all of his church, of all of our lives, all of our individual circumstances, and he's working everything according to his plan. So let's close in prayer. Lord, thank you that you are with us through everything and that you have a good plan for us. We can trust your promises even when it doesn't seem like they can possibly happen, that there is nothing impossible for you, and you have good plans for us. So I thank you for that. I thank you for these baptisms that we're going to be having today. Please be with these young people as they go through their lives with you and continue to work in them and shape them, mold them, guide them, and protect them, and help them to grow in you. And please help us all to grow together into the knowledge of you and to serve you well and to grow close to you. So I ask all these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.